welcome back to Off the Deaton Path. My name is Stan Deaton with the Georgia Historical Society, and we welcome you to this podcast for the week of January 9th, 2019. Happy New Year! My very special guest this week on the podcast is my friend Paul Presley. Paul is a longtime educator and is now the Director Emeritus of the Ossabaugh Island Education Alliance. Before his work with Ossabaugh, Paul served as principal and then headmaster of Savannah Country Day School for 23 years in total, where he influenced the lives of thousands of young people and where his influence is still very much felt. Paul serves on the Advisory Council Board of the University of Georgia Press, on the board of Bethesda Academy here in Savannah, and he is currently chairman of the board of the Hodge Foundation, also in Savannah. Paul has an undergraduate degree from Princeton and a PhD in history from Oxford University. In addition to his work as an educator, Paul is a renowned published scholar. He is the author of a book entitled On the Rim of the Caribbean, Colonial Georgia and the British Atlantic World, published in 2013 by the University of Georgia Press, and which won the Georgia Historical Society's Bell Award for the best book in Georgia history. His work has also been published by the Journal of Southern History and the Georgia Historical Quarterly, among others. Paul joins me today to talk about his latest book, a co-edited volume of essays entitled Coastal Nature, Coastal Culture, Environmental Histories of the Georgia Coast, published by the University of Georgia Press in 2018. Paul is co-editor of the volume, along with Paul Sutter of the University of Colorado Boulder. This interview was recorded at the Jepson House Education Center in Savannah on January 4th, 2019. Here's Paul Presley. Paul Presley, welcome to Off the Deaton Path.
I am delighted to be here, Stan. It's been a long friendship that we've had, and this is a special moment for me.
It has been, and I appreciate you saying that. You're one of the great people that I met when I came to Savannah over 20 years ago, and I'm delighted that we have maintained this friendship and all that you've done for the University of Georgia Press, for Georgia Historical Society, for the City of Savannah, and the State of Georgia. And we're going to talk about all of that in some detail. The primary reason I've got you here today is because your involvement in a book recently published by the University of Georgia Press. I have it right in front of me, a very handsome book. You're co-editor with Paul Sutter of a book called Coastal Nature, Coastal Culture, subtitled Environmental Histories of the Georgia Coast. We're going to have a wide-ranging discussion about this book, how it came about, the conference from which this book evolved. But first of all, I want you to tell me, because you were as long involved with the Ossabaugh Island Educational Alliance, and so this book is sort of grounded in Ossabaugh, I think. So first thing, I want you to tell our listeners about Ossabaugh Island, what it is, where it is, and how you got involved with it.
Well, Stan, you know, Ossabaugh Island, I think, is one of the best-kept secrets in Savannah. If you walk down Broughton Street and ask someone, what is Ossabaugh Island, at least half of them would say, I've never heard of it. It happens to be the third largest barrier island off the coast of Georgia. Only Cumberland Island and St. Simons are bigger than Ossabaugh.
And How big is it?
It's 26,000 acres. Now, let me put that into something that makes sense. That's 10 miles in length and 5 miles wide. So it's huge. And it's really two islands that sort of collided together. One is a Pleistocene island, the other is a Holocene island. You got two different sort of sets of vegetation on it. But in 1978, the state of Georgia bought it from the family that owned it, Mrs. Eleanor Torrey West and her family. And she decreed that it could only be used for study, research, and education. So that meant the Ossabaugh Island Foundation was created, a private nonprofit, to support the state in that educational function. And my job was to be, was as head of, director of, an education alliance. And that alliance included the Board of Regents. It included the Department of Natural Resources and the Ossabaugh Island Foundation.
So the island was owned by the West family, I believe, from the 1920s, maybe 1926 until 1978. Is that correct?
You know, the island's an incredible island. It's, you know, we talk about nature and culture, and people will come on. There was young one person that came on the island and said, oh, it's just so wonderful to be in the wilderness. because it's, you know, it's rugged. It's rugged. And it is not a wilderness. In fact, in 1775, there were three indigo plantations, 150 enslaved people. There was a shipyard, and they were cutting down the live oak timber. And there were 400 cattle on the island. So you can imagine how developed it was. It was very much part of the Atlantic economy. And again, that goes back to the whole shape of this book, Coastal Nature, talking about the Georgia Islands. I've gone through so many evolutions, and the human footprint is heavy on the coast, despite the fact of its beauty today.
And in fact, that's one of the themes of this book, I think, is that despite the rugged and wilderness nature of Georgia's coast, it has been very much shaped by culture and by human hands.
Yeah, exactly. You know, today, the incredible thing about it is Georgia really is very fortunate with this coast. Now, here's the great news. I saw a photograph once taken from a satellite, and it showed a picture of the eastern seaboard. And all the way from Bangor, Maine, down to Miami, Florida, it was a band of light. And sometimes that band of light was very big, and sometimes it was a little bit smaller, until you came to Georgia. And then it was relatively dark. And then you pick it up with Jacksonville and go all the way to Miami. So Georgia is very fortunate that these islands have been conserved, and there is a natural state there. And of the 11 islands, only four of them are developed. It's one of them is only partially developed, Jekyll. And seven of them are not even connected to the mainland by bridge. So Georgia's done something that South Carolina and Florida were not able to do.
How many, and this is not meant to be a trick question, and I'm asking because I don't know, how many coastal islands are there off the coast of Georgia?
As many as you want to count. If you want to count the hammocks, you know, I said 11 islands. That's the 11 major islands.
The ones that have names, I take it?
Well, no, you've got Wolf Island and Blackbeard Island. I'm not counting those.
Yes.
They're fairly small, and most people don't know very much about them. But, you know, you do Cumberland, Jekyll, St. Simons, Sea Island, Little St. Simons, Sapelo, St. Catharines, Ossabaw, Wausau, and then Tabby. Those are your principal islands.
And very quickly, Ossabaw does not have a bridge.
No.
How many permanent residents are on that island
right now,
at any given time?
Right now, there is one permanent resident. And until 5 years ago, there were only two permanent residents. One of them was Sandy West, Eleanor Torrey West, who was 98 years old. Actually, she left the island when she was about 102 years old. She's turning 106 this January. So it's been fairly deserted. She wanted the island to go back to a state of nature. And, of course, Department of Natural Resources was very happy to accommodate that.
And so the one person who lives on the island permanently, I believe, is the pig hunter.
It's a
DNR employee.
It's a DNR employee. He's a sharpshooter. And the fact is you have, and the DNR estimates, nobody knows, over 2,000 pigs. And they're very destructive. They've been there since the time of the Spanish. You can see that sort of dark coat, which is sort of Spanish pigs. Although the Morrell family, which owned the island in the late 18th century, brought over English pigs. But nevertheless, those 2,000 pigs, a lot of them go down to the beach between, let's say, May and September, and they wait for these loggerhead turtles to come in and lay their eggs, and then they go dig them up and eat them. So his job is to shoot them, and he has a quota of about 1,200 pigs a year that he has to kill. And he says, even when I do that, it is not enough. He says it just maintains the balance.
Wow. Mm. So if people listening to this who don't know anything about Ossabaw and they think, boy, I'd like to take a vacation there with my family next summer. That's impossible, right? People go out there under restricted conditions. There are no condos. There are no hotels. There's no place to stay, really.
That's right. There is a so-called clubhouse and a boarding house. The clubhouse is an old hunt house. And the boarding house was for some of the workers that were there before 1978. But today, it is the foundation maintains it for groups that visit, can stay overnight. You can stay for, say, up to a week or more. And if you are a writer or an artist, you can take a stay in the boarding house for pretty much as long as you want.
You have to bring your own food.
You've got to bring your own food. You have to take everything off with you. Mm-hmm. So it's a fairly primitive setting. But, you know, in the clubhouse, there are bunk beds. The bunk beds come out of Brumby Hall at the University of Georgia. The president of the University of Georgia visited, and he said, oh, I've got some beds for you. And I've been amazed. I've seen people who are 80 years old sleep in the top of a bunk bed, and be perfectly happy. I mean, somehow things change when you're on that island.
Mm. Mm. Let me ask you this. I will segue into the book and the subject of this book. How did Georgia, you mentioned we're fortunate, how did we get so fortunate to have coastal islands that, by and large, are not developed in the way that Hilton Head Island is, yeah, or other places on the coast of the United States? How did this, was it by accident or design in Georgia?
I think, fairly much by accident, but it was after, of course, the Civil War. And after the Civil War, the islands were deserted. The labor force was no longer there. They were freed. They went to the mainland. The planters tried to maintain, but they were not successful. And eventually, families primarily from the north, wealthy industrialists like the Carnegie family. You had the Parsons family the Carnegies bought Cumberland Island, as you know. The Parsons bought Wausau. And finally, in 1924, Ossabaw was purchased by the Torrey family. Prior to that, it had been somebody, trying to think of the name, a great department store in Philadelphia, that Wanamaker had bought it in 1898. But the Torreys bought the island in 1924, and they're sort of the last of the big wealthy families. They made their money in Pittsburgh Plate Glass and in a chemical company. Mm-hmm. And they were there really for recreation. It really raises some questions about, these were industrialists. As somebody has pointed out, these were the ones that were polluting the north, and they came to the south to escape. And the island was sort of a retreat for them.
A private playground.
Private playground. And, of course, many of them fell in love with the islands. And to a large extent, in the 1960s and 70s, they turned the islands over to the state or to the federal government.
So tell me about this book. This is part of a series at the University of Georgia Press entitled Environmental History in the American South. Where did the idea for this book come from, and what is going on? I know that environmental history has become increasingly a very popular subject among academic historians. Tell me how this came together.
Well, you know, a professor at Armstrong State University, and it's now Armstrong Campus of Georgia State University, Mark Finley.
Georgia Southern,
I'm sorry, came to me and said, you know, you did the Ossabaw Island Foundation, the Education Alliance, did a wonderful symposium in 2008 on African-American life in the Georgia coast. And my vision was that the history of the Georgia coast is not properly told. South Carolina has done so much more with African-American history. So we put on this symposium in 2008. It went very well. A wonderful book came out of it. And Mark Finley watched it. He was working on a book on Ossabaw Island. He wanted to put Ossabaw Island into the environmental movement of the 1960s. So we sort of agreed. I kind of hesitated because the recession of 2009 had come with raising money and putting on something of that we couldn't do. And finally, we agreed. Mark and I called together a planning committee. You eventually were on that planning committee. But it was two people, John Insko and Dorinda Dalmeyer from University of Georgia, and Chris Curtis from now Georgia Southern University, and Sarah Ross from Wormsloe, and so on. Elizabeth DuBose, the Ossabaw Island Foundation. We had our first meeting, came up with wonderful speakers, and Mark left us. He invited me at that point to go down with him to see Jimmy Carter and have lunch with him, to ask him some questions for his Ossabaw book. And we did, and it was a wonderful experience. The next week, he drove up to Philadelphia, and driving back, it was a history conference, and driving back, he was killed on Highway 95. So that sort of threw us for a loop. I mean, it was a great personal loss, a great loss for Armstrong and for the world of history and the environmental history. But our book is dedicated to his memory and try to honor a great historian and somebody who really provided the inspiration for coastal nature, coastal culture.
And this the book came out of a conference that was held in Savannah that you really were one of the prime movers on. This is what you're talking about. It was held February 18 through 20, 2016. Hard for me to believe it was 3 years ago now, but it was. Tell me about that conference and then the process of putting this book together.
Well, let me start off by telling you the conference was a great success. We had 400 people attend, a little in excess of 400. They showed up, this is the Coastal Georgia Center, they showed up that first day, and most of them stayed with us until Saturday morning, and our speakers were just dumbfounded. They'd never seen 400 people sitting there for almost 2 days listening. The planning committee selected speakers. I invited them and worked with them. We've got some senior historians. We've got some stellar people. We've got some younger historians. And it's made for a very rich mix. One of the people that I'm proudest of is that we secured, convinced Taya Miles of the University of Michigan. She's an African-American professor of African-American history. She has received a MacArthur Genius Grant, and it was on Cherokees and enslaved people in North Georgia in the early 19th century. But she agreed to do this and produce one of the best chapters in our book.
I noticed that you've got the list of contributors. There's a total of how many in here?
10.
About 10 people.
Yes.
You, Paul Sutter, is a professor, I believe, in Colorado.
Yes.
Is that right?
Yes.
Of environmental history.
Right.
You edited this with him. Before we get into the individual essays and what themes are being explored here and what we now know as a result of this book, tell our audience what an editor of a volume like this does exactly.
It's been a wonderful experience for me. It's been a humbling experience because I've worked with two great people, Philip Morgan and for the first volume and Paul Sutter. And of course, the first thing that had to be done, and Paul Sutter led this process, we read each of the papers. The papers 6 months after the conference, contributors turned in formal papers ready for publication. Well, guess what? They weren't all ready for publication. They had to be shaped up. The themes had to be tightened. Some people had wandered off this way or that way. So and what I've also learned is editors, really good editors, are discreet. They don't criticize roundly. They just sort of say, this is what you need to be doing. They don't raise their voices. I was so impressed with Paul and Philip on this. But we pulled together those common themes and our contributors responded to that. The other thing that editors do is you read the paper for citations. You've got to be sure that those citations are accurate. And sometimes in the process of rushing through research, there can be some slippage.
So editors, commonly people think that editors are copy editors, that you're going through and saying, oh, you need a comma here, or this is not the right word. But being an editor is far more than that. It's really being able to step up and see the whole project at a 10,000-foot level and craft this in a way. And sometimes it's giving people bad news, right?
Right, exactly. Sometimes you have to tell people that their paper might not be included in the book, which, happens.
Mm-hmm. Or that their work, while it was okay as a conference paper, as you referred to, is not up to speed for a publication.
But you made a good point about copy editing, because I think most people coming from the outside think of editing as copy editing. You're looking for grammar and syntax and spelling and this and that. That is not what editing is at all. There is the University of Georgia Press hires a copy editor. It's a contract basis. And that person spends considerable time going through at that level.
I'm looking at the table of contents here with some of the scholars that I will mention some of. Again, Paul, you mentioned Paul Sutter, of course, at the University of Colorado at Boulder. Mark Stewart is in here, one of the great historians, environmental historians of Georgia. Yeah. David Hurst Thomas, an anthropologist, I believe.
Yeah. Archaeologist.
Archaeologist, thank you.
And anthropologist.
Max Edelson, who is, of course, just one of the best historians of early America, who's out there right now, and he did a chapter on cartography, which I know I saw the original presentation. Etta Fields Black is in here. You mentioned Taya Miles. Drew Swanson, who is just one of the best environmental historians. Albert Way, William Boyd, Christopher Mangianello, and Janice Ray. These are all top flight scholars. Give our audience, if you will, kind of a thumbnail sketch about what kind of themes are they exploring and what was the big news that came out of this volume?
Well, let me start off with the big news, because I think that sort of fits all of their contributions within it. And the idea was that culture and nature cannot be separated. People tend to think, and it's only natural, that when you see a natural setting, that is the way it is. In fact, the human footprint has usually been in that natural setting. Certainly that's the case for the Georgia coast. So the whole purpose of this book is to tease out the human history that's buried on the coast of Georgia. And buried, it means digging it up and bringing it out to celebrate it. So each chapter deals with a different group that came onto the coast over hundreds of years and brought a certain vision and reshaped the land into their landscape that reflected their values. But at the same time, you've got a natural setting that forces them to change that vision. So you've got even Native Americans who were nomadic, became non-nomadic on those islands, developed a high-protein diet, and people think, well, they didn't leave any trace. But of course they left traces. If you go on to Osobo Island, you find 250 shell middens, or oyster shells. And you think of the impact of those oyster shells up and down the coast on our building, on our tabby construction. You look at the industrialists that came in brought industrial cutting of longleaf pine, and how much that they tore up the landscape. And yet that landscape has recovered. But you know, in recovering, it will never be what it was before 1860.
This is a non-traditional way, if you will, of looking at history. 50 years ago, 75 years ago, maybe even 25 years ago. If you come to the history of Georgia or anything, there's a traditional approach to history, looking at it, politics, individuals. This is a different way, in two ways, it seems to me, both because you're looking at environmental history, but as the culture. What does that word mean in this context? When you say it's shaped by culture, what is culture? What are we talking about?
Think about this. Let's go back to early Georgia. Let's go back to Trusteeship, Georgia, which you know quite a bit about. Let's go back to Oglethorpe. Oglethorpe and the trustees created the colony of Georgia. I mean, King George gave them a charter to create this colony that brought a special vision, and it was for decayed tradesmen, as the Earl of Egmont said. It was for the worthy poor, and they set up land planning. Savannah, Augusta, Frederica, very, very structured. It was an ordered agrarian society. And of course, it didn't work. It was changed. That environment sort of ate them up. But they left a legacy in terms of the kind of culture that they imprinted on this, not for self, but for others. But 1750, it's an economic failure, and adoption of plantation slavery takes place, and actually the Georgia economy takes off at that point in time. You take the rice planters, and I think most people don't realize that rice was the first export crop of Georgia. I mean, Georgia's wealth in the third quarter of the 18th century was built on rice, and much of it in the early 19th century was built on rice. And that was a complete transformation of the landscape. But you look at it today, and you find traces on Savannah Wildlife Refuge, Hoffel Broadfield, if you go up the Ogeechee River.
So How does this book and these sorts of questions that these scholars are asking, how does it change on a broader level how we understand not just Georgia, but maybe American history? And even beyond American history, is this a new way of looking at the past?
Well, I think it is, because it forces us to kind of look at we're not looking at silos. We're not looking at political. We're not looking at economic. We're bringing nature into this, and it's not a simplistic thing. It's a very complicated process. Let me give you an example of this with Taya Miles' article, which is on Igbo Landing. And you talk about culture and the relationship. It's actually not exactly about environment. It's talking about resistance. And it's talking about a slave ship that comes into Georgia on the coast in 1803. And a group of enslaved people are shipped to St. Simons. And they revolt when they reach St. Simons. And they commit an act of collective suicide. In March, the three white sailors were killed and jumped overboard and were drowned. And then these Igbos, about 20, jumped into the marsh, and most of them were drowned, an act of collective suicide. It says a lot about the rice plantation that they were going to, about the harshness of the regime. But that little act has become a symbol that really has built its way into African-American literature. The fact that most people think of African-Americans, Gullah Geechee, as simply being a static culture, and they think in terms of food ways. But there's a lot more to it, and it was not static, and there was resistance. But I think by including the rice plantation, the whole natural setting of St. Simons and the coast of Georgia, it provides a very powerful understanding of what is in African-American literature. The interesting thing is you don't see this very much in the general culture, but with African-American culture, it's quite important.
And I know St. Simons, if you go there now, you see a very ordered landscape. It is a tourist mecca. It's not overdeveloped, but it is certainly developed. And it sort of belies the fact that in the 19th century, there were 14 plantations there that could be described as enslaved labor camps. Totally different landscape in the way it looked and the way it felt. And they were producing Sea Island cotton there under extraordinarily difficult conditions. No sense of that now. This is sort of what we're talking about, right?
And there's a supreme irony on this that Taya Miles brought out. She says today, you know, Igbo Landing is marked by a little bit of a marker, but not much of one. And in fact, there is a water pollution control discharge of wastewater from a high-end residential neighborhood that comes there. And she says, you know, it's sort of tragic to see that. She says, you know, she was hoping that her contribution would lead to some action on the part of folks on St. Simons to do something to recognize what is a huge story.
It leads me to the question that we think about these islands now. You mentioned what people think when they first go to Asabal. They look at it and they say, oh my goodness, this is just a beautiful, peaceful place.
Yeah.
It sort of belies the fact that all of these islands were places of, I think, correct me if I'm wrong, enormous contention and especially violence for most of their history.
Well, I think the story of Igbo Landing shows that certainly on Asabal. And again, my personal research, which I continue, is fugitive slaves from Asabal Island in the late 18th and early 19th century. One man named Titus, who led a total of 28 enslaved people to Spanish Florida. People forget that Spanish Florida was there from 1784 till 1821. And people forget that the Spanish had missions on the Georgia coast in the 17th and early 18th century. Again, their impact on that setting, how does that change the way we see things? I think it makes people feel today, in terms of culture, to understand the economics and to understand the natural setting, it makes people feel more inclusive. It helps provide a greater understanding. It's sophistication.
And these islands continue to play a vital role in the economy and, I think, politics of Georgia, right? All the discussions we have now about offshore drilling and that sort of thing all comes into effect here. These islands are still very important to the state.
They are. And Stan, one of the things that's most interesting, there's a chapter there on the environmental movement of the 1960s. How did the Georgia marsh find protection? Because it was beginning to be eaten up. It was beginning to be used for private development. And in the 1960s, Kerr McKee Corporation mines phosphates. It mines phosphates in Florida. So they proposed to mine phosphates in Wausau Sound. They proposed to build it in further down the coast as well. And they said they would build new communities built up with a dredge and that birds could settle on it. And that touched off a firestorm. Anybody that's seen what a phosphate mine looks like on the coast, basically you're destroying the marsh and creating a pile of muck. It didn't work. And at that point in time, you had a coalition that formed. And we've never had an environmental coalition like this because you had garden club ladies who were the tea parties of the 1960s. You had environmentalists, you had scientists, you had hippies, and you had very conservative business people who realized that we need to do something. This is something, and tourism is worth something. We also had a governor, Lester Maddox, who was had a very conservative individual, and he finally joined this coalition and signed an act. This became the Coastal Marshland Protection Act. So, you know, to understand that has made me realize the marsh is threatened today.
That was my next question. Are these islands still under threat?
It is threatened today. And so if you read a chapter like this, you could sit there and smile and feel relaxed because the marsh was saved. Well, it wasn't saved. The Coastal Marshland Protection Act, by the way, was the toughest marshland protection act anywhere in the United States. Georgia really set the standard. But since then, there's been a lot of slippage. And part of it's not political. Part of it is simply that the rivers are bringing so much runoff of pollutants that it's damaging the marsh, tremendous damage.
Inland rivers. You've been flowing
inland rivers.
The coast.
I mean the Savannah, the Ogeechee, the Altamaha. You know, it's somebody that's putting fertilizer in their yard, a certain kind of fertilizer, and having it run off and into a creek and so on into the rivers. It's tremendously damaging. And also, there's also development in everybody. There's so many ways. Development's going to come. Georgia coast is being developed, but there just has to be a compromise, a balance. And maintaining that balance is difficult. I think most Georgians, whatever their background, appreciate that there is. We need to achieve that balance.
It's easy for someone to go to Ossabaw, or really any of the coastal islands, I think, but particularly Ossabaw, and you think, wow, you know, somebody with very clear vision many years ago preserved this for future generations, and you think, this could never become like Hilton Head. Could it? I mean, is there a chance that in the future, 100 years from now, Ossabaw will have a bridge and condominiums and Walmart and box stores? Is that a possibility?
You know, it's so interesting. When Mrs. West sold the island to the state in 1978, she had that vision that things can happen. The state legislature and the governor can change their minds. And ultimately, you know, they're the ones that call the shots. So she had a whole set of lawyers work with DNR to set up a very, very strict contract about how the island can be used. Nevertheless, you have to worry about it. And one of my goals as head of the Education Alliance was to build up groups of people in this community, in the state, in the region, who feel very protective of Ossabaw and very protective of the islands and understand what the issues are. But let me tell you, we talk about as if it's developers versus naturalists, environmentalists. That is so simplistic. It really doesn't hold a lot of water. And give you an example, Paul Sutter starts off his introduction in the book talking about Cumberland Island in the 1970s. And he said, you know, Charles Frazier, who was developing Hilton Head and had established changed fundamentally Hilton Head into a tourist site, but, you know, very well done, but it was changed. Wanted to do the same thing for Cumberland Island and approach the Carnegies. And finally, a decision was made by the descendants not to do that, to give this to the federal government. So what did Fraser do? He went back to Hilton Head, and he led the charge against, I want to say DuPont. It's not DuPont. It's one of the great chemical companies that wanted to build a plant on Port Royal Sound. And he put together a tremendous environmental coalition that defeated it and maintained that sound for us to enjoy today. So here you have a man who was a developer who was also a great environmentalist. It depends on what the circumstances are.
So it sounds like in some ways this book, though it focuses on the history of coastal Georgia, is really also a call to arms.
Yeah.
To give people the sense of how much human hands, human history, human decisions have played and continue to play in the way these islands develop and how they look.
Absolutely. It really sets forth what a gem that we have on the coast of Georgia and how we need to preserve it, but need to preserve it intelligently. And what our hope is, I think everybody who played a role in this, the contributors, the academics, the Ossabaugh Island Foundation, what our hope is to see this book serve as kind of a guideline when people have discussions, when policymakers have a discussion. You've got some idea about groundwater issues. This book provides a historical framework. It's a baseline for discussions for the future.
Paul, really quickly.
I just have to say,
yes.
Groundwater extraction is one of the big issues. It's one of the last chapters. And William Boyd does a marvelous job of describing the craft industry and how it came and how it economically it saved the coast in the 1930s. But the amount of clean, inexpensive water it's had to subtract is just enormous. And what you have is the Florida Aquifer. And it's a chapter on the Florida Aquifer and its relationship and the politics around it in Georgia. And at this point in time, there's been so much extraction. And now it's not just the craft industry. It's Savannah. It's municipalities that are growing and developing. You take the two together, and you're beginning to have evidence of saltwater intrusion. And that's extraordinarily dangerous. I mean, that story is a continuing story. South Carolina has a pending lawsuit against the state of Georgia because of what it says is saltwater intrusion in Hilton Head. So the issues are quite big, and they're ongoing. And this book is a call to arms.
Well, and of course, the environment, climate change, to use a politically loaded word, all of these things are playing out every day on the American political scene. And so it's a very timely book. It's, I think, one that people, you stand on new ground when you read this and you look at this. So well done. And keep up the good work. Very quickly, I just want to ask you about your personal work that you're a published scholar. You very recently had an article in the Journal of Southern History. You have, as you mentioned, you have edited two volumes for the University of Georgia Press, and you have published a volume with the University of Georgia Press, a monograph that you wrote. What's Paul Presley working on right now?
Well, I'm working on a topic. I'm fairly far along in it, but it's a tough one, and it's what it's called Shaping the Southeast. I'm interested in how the Southeast, which today is South Carolina, Georgia, Alabama, and Florida, took shape. But I'm looking at it in the 18th and early 19th century, and I'm looking at it from a special lens, a very narrow lens. One of the forces, I think, contributed to the shaping of the Southeast, and that was fugitive slaves. And it's looking at the Georgia Lowcountry and looking at their flight to Spanish Florida, to the Seminoles, to the Creek Nation, looking at the response of white Georgians to that, and how this process unfolded from the middle of the 18th century to the first couple of decades of the 19th century. It's ambitious. But it's fun. But I do think that African American history is an area that in the Southeast that needs support.
Very quickly, I'll ask, what is the primary source one uses to investigate this subject? Because you're looking at a group that did not tend, generally, to leave a lot of written sources, the kind of traditional things we think about.
It is a variety of sources. It will, you know, you can see that I'm bald, and there's a reason for that. I'm trying to find all of it. The primary thing that I have found to be is a source that's only now beginning to be fully exploited, only now since the 1990s, and that's the Spanish archives, known as the East Florida Papers. The Spanish left Florida in 1821. There was a treaty, sold East and West Florida to the United States. And the incredible thing about it, and this is the only example I know of in all of North America, they left every single piece of paper, every scrap. And the Spanish bureaucracy was diligent, in fact, notorious for paperwork. And all of that is now in the Library of Congress. It's been microfilmed, and it's at University of Florida, at Emory University. So that has been a primary source for me.
Written in Spanish, presumably.
Well, it's, you know, keep in mind, in Spanish Florida from 1784 to 1821, 85% of the people there were Anglos. Mm. They were loyalists, and they were Georgia planters. So you have it. But yeah, a lot of it's written in Spanish. And I do have assistance from someone at Georgia Southern University who helps me in the translation.
Wow. Okay. Well, that sounds exciting, and I think will be the subject of a future podcast, because I know this will see print in the not-too-distant future, I hope. Well, Paul Presley, you're heavily involved in many things around our state. I know you sit on the advisory council board of the University of Georgia Press. You're on the board of the Bethesda Academy here in Savannah. You're the chairman of the board of the Hodge Foundation, which does a lot of good work in granting money. You've had an incredible impact on the youth of this for many years. You were associated with Savannah Country Day School as a principal, as a headmaster. You've spent your life in education. Yeah. You continue to do that. I wish you continued good luck, good health in everything that you do.
And Stan, thank you for what you do. I've enjoyed our association over these many years, and I look forward to continuing that association.
Thanks, Paul.
Okay.
And that concludes our interview with Paul Presley, co-editor of a new book entitled Coastal Nature, Coastal Culture, Environmental Histories of the Georgia Coast, published by the University of Georgia Press in 2018. The interview was conducted at the Jepson House Education Center in Savannah on January 4th, 2019. The hardest working engineer in show business, now the czar of our Tallahassee office, as well as the captain of the GHS Under 40 kickball team, is our very own Brendan Cannonball Krellen. Our mailman this week and every week is Crimson Tide fan extraordinaire, one Gary F. Taylor, born and raised, that's right, who is away this week drowning his sorrows over the devastating loss to Clemson in the national championship game by attending the Schmeckfest in Freeman, South Dakota. But he promises to be back next week. Our legal counsel this week and every week is provided by the law offices of Gallipo and Taylor, where their motto is, if you're going to waste your money, waste it on us. Catering this week provided by Hagee's House of Tacos, home of Big Al's caramelized, uncivilized, digitized, downsized, fossilized, unsupervised, widely despised, watch it metastasize, make sure it's sterilized, eat it and you'll be paralyzed, drippy enchilada. If you have an iPhone, you can find our podcast at the App Store or on the podcast app on your phone. If you have an Android, look for us at Google Play. Tell your friends and family, because everyone loves Paul Presley. You can find out everything about the Georgia Historical Society at georgiahistory.com and the Georgia History Festival at georgiahistoryfestival.org. Please also check out my blog and similarly environmentally devastating podcast at deatonpath.georgiahistory.com. If you have any comments about this show or about life in general, like the Facebook commentator that said a recent podcast was, quote, boring and uninspiring, another satisfied customer, drop me a line at sdeaton@georgiahistory.com. As always, thank you for listening. We hope you'll come back next week. So long, everybody.